Well, as I said this morning, we are very privileged and excited to have Bill and Ann Parkinson join us this morning. Give you that. Let's give them a hand.
Ann would bow. You know her. Yep.
So Bill and Ann are coming up on their 50th wedding anniversary in June. Yeah?
It can be done. It can be done.
Okay. Bill and Ann are part of the original team that planted Fellowship. So they have been here almost as long as they've been married, 40 years.
Since dirt.
There you have it. There you have it. So they have been on staff here from the time the church began. They were part of the team that planted Fellowship, and we are so thankful for them. Many of you might know one of their sons, Ben Parkinson, who's now a teaching pastor here, but they have four kids, Bill, Betsy, Ben, and Dan. And somehow they're all here in Little Rock, so I've got to get some
lessons one time they were in San Francisco, Dallas, Houston, and Memphis. And God brought them all back. So
wow.
As your children disperse, know that there's hope. Okay, come back.
If you know Bill and Ann at all, you know that they are just a tiny bit different when it comes to personality. Yeah. Just a tiny bit. Are you on? I'm sorry. There you go.
Okay.
Now you're on.
That right there was hell for Ann, okay? When the mic doesn't work and she's cut off, that's...
I think you planned it. Thank you. Do you want to show
us
pictures
Ann,
now?
So, Ann, you want to show
okay,
us? Ann brought us a couple
of
pictures of their family.
Of pictures. Just so you'll know, we really were young once. Okay, there was a marriage one, but that's where we started.
Yeah.
There we are. So we were 22 at that time. So, and then when we started Fellowship.
Actually, Ann was. She's older than I am. So.
6 months, and he never lets me forget it. Anyway, okay. And then the next one, okay, the church was 3 years old. No, one, because there's Daniel. So notice he is wet through his little outfit. So he's in his pamper. We're trying to do a family picture. Is that not just typical? I mean, it was just, he barely stayed in my lap. But they do grow up, so we've been through this stage. I had three and under, the first three, and then along came Dan 4 years later. And then they do get a little bit older, and the next one, there we are. And by that time, I had three teenagers and a seven-year-old. So, you know, we have been the gamut of it and experienced it and made it through.
That's where you're headed, the three teenagers. And it's what I call the monstrous middle of life.
You're not supposed to go there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another talk.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm there, so I might need to come see you privately. Yeah. So Ann is a 7 on the Enneagram, which we probably knew. Yeah, we probably guessed. And remember, that 7 really loves to just experience life. They love to just move from one thing to the next. They are experience-oriented. Okay, now Bill, on the other hand, is a 3. And we know that 3 is that successful, achiever-oriented, goal-oriented kind of personality. So I thought it'd be just fun to give you a little bit of insight into them, for us to just start and let each of them describe kind of what would their ideal day be if they were on vacation. Okay, just give you a little insight into their differences. So, Ann, what would your ideal day on vacation look like?
Okay, my ideal day would be not too early, but once you get up, you've already looked in your guidebook to see what is there that is exciting, and you're going to hit the road so you don't miss. I mean, if it's a waterfall, if you're in New York City, if it's the MoMA, I mean, you're going to find something exciting to do that day. So I just want to be sure I don't miss it, because I might not be back there again.
Okay, so you're going to cover it all. Bill, what would your day look like?
Vacation is role reversal for us. You know, the 3 is achiever-oriented.
That's true.
So on vacation, my day is at the beach, in the chair, reading a book, looking out at the ocean as the sun goes down, with a nice drink in my hand. That's my
Does it
day.
Have an umbrella? That's what I want to know. Uh-huh.
A little umbrella.
A little umbrella. Okay.
Yeah. So you can see a little bit the differences we're hearing. We're going to come back to kind of how that plays out on vacation, even for them now, and just kind of in their everyday life. But let's go back a little earlier. Let's kind of set the stage. And Bill, tell us a little bit even about your childhood and kind of your early adult years and sort of how that played into and formed who you were and how that kind of carried into your marriage.
Let me just say, every one of us brings baggage into our marriage, and you don't even know what it is. Okay, you discover over time why you are the way you are. And so it takes time. So you don't even know when you say love, you say the vows, right? And for better or for worse, and you have no idea what that is because you're pretty much seeing the better part, you know, as you're getting married. And then the baggage comes along as well. Yeah, yeah, which you don't even know. Yeah. So for me, the baggage is, I mean, I looked okay on the outside, but I grew up with a one for a dad, okay? And he was pretty driven and perfectionistic, and he was very involved in his job. He was the youngest of four growing up in a very wealthy family, and he was the least productive of those four. And so as he moved through life, he had to prove himself to the family. And he used to tell me, son, nobody cares what your family's name is when you get out in the world. You're going to have to make it on your own. You're going to figure that out. And if there's a job to do, be the job, great or small, do it right or not at all. But he was so driven and busy trying to prove himself that his approach to life with us was, here are the resources. He was a great provider. Now you go figure out how to use these. I really don't have time for that. Those words were never spoken. That's how life was lived out. So as a result of that, I learned how to process life alone. So you take resources, you try to figure out what the answers are, you're fairly perfectionistic because your dad required a pretty high standard to succeed. And so if I were to describe myself as I was growing up and some of the things I've had to overcome, it would be this. I was personable, but not personal. So you might think, boy, Bill's fun to be with. We're here in the room. He's sharing all these stories about his life and the whole thing. But I really don't know much more about him or what he feels or his weaknesses or his strengths. It's a kind of a fake intimacy. It's Facebook, okay? I just kind of let you see what I want you to see and what the picture looks like there. So that's what I learned how to do. As a result, created some intimacy issues with Ann and myself, because I'm not really sure I can share things with her. I don't include her in the process because I've learned how to process life alone. So she finds out, and if she were telling this story, we'd be here all morning, okay? But she finds out that I have, on a retreat, that I have become a Christian on a little boat ride out in the lake. I become a Christian, and the next question is, would you like to go into full-time ministry? She finds that all out in a...
Two sentences.
Yes, I've become a Christian. Would you like to go on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ? And so she's going, what? I mean, she has no idea where I am. So then we go on crusade staff. We're there for 4 years, and I'm starting to think, I have a gift more in the area of teaching than evangelism, so... To me, it seems like seminary might be a good next step, but I have no idea if I can get in seminary. Got to pass a GRE. I've got to do all this kind of stuff. And so behind the scenes, I do all of this. I make application. I get accepted to Dallas Seminary. And I come to her one day and say, what would you think about going to seminary? And she goes, what?
And luckily... One of my, in a seven, you're flexible. So, and I wanted to go on crusade staff. I just never thought he would. And we didn't become Christians till we were 21, 22, and did not grow up in Christian homes. So I was shocked, but I was okay with that one. With this one, it really hurt my feelings, because here we are, a Christian couple. We've been married 4 years, and I thought we should have prayed about this, you know? And all of a sudden, it's like it wasn't that I didn't think it was a good idea, because I saw his gifting, and mine was evangelism. I could have stayed on campus with students for the rest of my life, but I knew that wasn't Bill's gift. So it wasn't that I doubted it, but it did hurt that I didn't get to pray about it. I didn't get to anticipate it. When the letter came, it was like, well, so what? So mm-hmm. that hurt.
Yeah. So you can see, you can very clearly see the three achiever mapping it out. I got the goal, and the seven missed out on what? The experience.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, Ann, tell us a little bit about, I know that these 1 Corinthians 13 verses, there's part of them in a specific translation that really meant a lot to you early on in your marriage. So tell us a little bit about how that impacted you.
Right, right. Let's see. Oh, Jake, put that verse up there. 1 Corinthians 7 and 8. And I'll tell you the reason this was so important to me is, like I said, Bill and I did not come out. We came out of moral homes, and we came out of families that really cared about us. So it was a good home. It was not a Christian home. And but we were fortunate, or I was, to hear before Bill was a Christian that I was to marry a Christian. And Billy Graham said I should let God pick it out, which I thought was rather bizarre, but I was willing to try. So I just said, all right, God, you pick out the guy for me. And if it's not Bill, just break us up. Because, you know, I love him, but I'm willing to get hurt. And that's all I knew to do as a Christian of 8 months. And our sweet leader of Campus Crusade at Arkansas said, Ann, be careful when you tell your testimony, because you kind of did it all wrong, but God knew your heart was right. So, but anyway, so as Bill did become a Christian, and he was, and really, truly be honest with you, I thought, you know what, it's just better if we break up and I find somebody brand new, you know, because we'd made some mistakes and things, and I thought, I just need to find a good Christian guy and start over. There is no good Christian guy or girl to start over with. I mean, it's like, I thought that would be best. God said, no, you know, this is the man I have for you. And that's true. Wherever you are, that is the man God has for you. But anyway, as that time went on, I knew God had picked Bill out because I'd given him. And I gave him every boyfriend I'd ever had. I said, you know what? You can go back and get blah, blah,
and
blah, blah, blah.
She had a lot.
Yeah,
mean,
well, not,
a...
no, I only had three. But I gave them all to God.
She was a fraternity sweetheart.
And... Oh, be quiet. So anyway, but here's the thing. I was committed to God to pick out Bill. And then as we got to know Don and Sally Meredith that wrote the material that Family Life uses, and they would talk about God, that you are to be committed to the Lord first when you're married. That's where you're made a contract with God, and to your mate. And as Bill was in seminary, I ran across these verses in the Living Bible, and it says, and I realized that I had committed to God that I was to be married to Bill. I had not committed to Bill that he was the one God picked out for me, with all of his strengths, with all of his weaknesses, that I needed those weaknesses to conform me to the image of Christ. And Howard Hendricks would say, it's like putting two rough stones in a bag and shaking them, and over the years they become smooth. And I thought, God looked down and went, oh my Lord, if I don't put this one together with that one, they're gonna be no earthly good to me, because they are so rocky and I've got to rub off those rough edges. But this verse was the one, and it says, if you love someone, you will always be loyal to him no matter what the cost. And you know what? Bill, as a three, the one thing he fears is being exposed or embarrassed. And early in our marriage, I don't suffer from that. And I love to get a laugh, and to get a laugh,
And late in our marriage.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, that's true. And I would just share my weaknesses, my vulnerability. I'm more vulnerable. But here's the thing. One day he came, and I would lamp over into his weaknesses. And he came home after one party or something. He said, look, if I want to share where I made a mistake or where I'm weak, he said, I can do that, but you can't do that. And luckily, I said, you know what? You're right. I don't have the right to do that.
We used to have sharing services on Sunday mornings here, and I would be the sharing leader. And people would raise their hand to share, and Ann would raise her hand. and I would start to sweat. Because I can't shut her up right there in the middle of the congregation.
I never shared anything in there, just other
places.
Oh,
my goodness. Oh,
well, maybe I did. Okay. Okay. So anyway, I learned that I did not have the right to share Bill's weaknesses. That was personal. That was up to him. And then it says you will always believe in him and always expect the best of him. And what God said to me is don't be suspicious. Don't always think his motives are to get you. Because since he was raised by a perfectionistic dad, I was on a performance basis too. But I realized he had himself on one, but I always felt like I was on one. But I need to expect the best, not the worst. And always stand your ground in defending him. And I realized that, you know, that goes with attitude, that he has a job to do. Our church, there's no way 300 people are going to support three, or 180 when we start, or it's going to support three pastors, which we always started with three. So Bill was doing Walk Through the Bible seminars to help on weekends to help bring in some money for us to live on. And he'd be gone. And then he started missions here. He's got a gift with just his visionary. And the first mission trip to Haiti, all of a sudden, Bill Jr. was about, oh gosh, eight. And he'd been gone a week and a half, and he goes, Mom, when is Dad coming home? And I said, well, you know, he's down there in Haiti, and he says, well, why did he have to go? And so I said, well, Bill, I said, it says in Romans 10:14, you know, why, how will they know without someone going and telling him? And all of a sudden, and we knew that Ben was not a believer because he'd quit praying, and we'd say at night, and he was five, and we'd say, well, do you want to say prayers? He said, no, you can, I don't want to. So we didn't, and...
this is your pastor.
But as Bill was sitting there, and I was explaining to him why his dad was there, and you can either have a positive attitude on why your husband travels or a negative, and you can either put him in a positive light or a negative light. And as I was sitting there explaining that to Bill, I heard this little voice as I said, well, how are they going to know? They're not going to know how to go to heaven if someone isn't there to tell them about Jesus. And then I heard this little voice like 2 feet over in the other twin bed go, well, that's just the problem. I don't know if I'm going to heaven or not. And I went, well, Ben, do you want to? And he goes, yes. So I immediately went over two feet and went through the plan of salvation, and he prayed to receive Christ that night. And Bill got home from Haiti. We're saying our prayers, and all of a sudden Ben prayed, and he goes. So, I mean, that was it. From then on, he was praying, and he was in there. But I thought if I had not had the positive attitude, if I had not explained it in that way, gosh, what I would have missed out on.
Wow. What an amazing story of... your reaction and how that impacted your kids when you could have said, you know, I don't know, I'm ready for him to be home too.
I'm doing all
because I know I've said that in my house before. It's easy to get caught in that. So when we were talking the other day, you guys told me that early on, it was either right after you married or right before you were getting married, somebody told you that you guys were so different, there was no way you would make it.
We were given a test. Robert Lewis had a great idea to bring in Bob Beale, and he tested all three of the preaching pastors and their wives. And of course, Robert and Sherrod fit the mold perfectly. I don't know what happened to Bill and Carolyn. He got to us and he goes, So this would really work out better if y'all were reversed. And I thought, well, that's encouraging. And then he kind of, he didn't say much else. And I thought, he doesn't think we're going to make it. I still want to go back and talk to that man. Yeah. And I think I'm going to invite him to our 50th anniversary party.
There you go. Perfect. So tell us I know it hasn't always been easy.
Well,
how have you guys done
it? We've been to a number of seminars, and I really encourage them for you. We've been to counseling as well, which has been very helpful for us. But in one of these marriage seminars we went to, they gave you this test, and they said, here are 43 questions, and you're probably going to be more on one side or on the other of this, and this will tell you areas that you all can work on in your marriage relationship, areas where you're different. We were on the opposite end of the spectrum in 41 out of 43, okay? So that's a little overwhelming to think about how are we going to work on all these things. But we realized that what was drawing us together was our relationship with God. That was the key. We were different, but as long as we were moving toward Christ and pursuing Him, that was going to bring us together. And I remember a pastor that Ben actually did a discipleship program under in Dallas, Texas. His name is Tommy Nelson. And Tommy said, boy, when you're looking to get married, he said, you ought to run as hard as you can after Jesus and look to your left or your right and see who's there. And that would be a pretty good options as far as who you might marry. And so all of us are beyond that, okay? we've already run that race. And now we're married to who we are married to. And there are going to be differences in your relationship. But I love this illustration. Differences can either bring you together or they can pull you apart. It depends on how you respond to them. And so there was a ship carrying Nike shoes on it that went through a storm up in the North Alaskan Sea, and crates were washed overboard and broken apart, and all of the left shoes ended up on the Alaskan coast, and all the right shoes ended up in the California Current on the California coast. And the currents of life took these two shoes that look very similar, but they're shaped just a little bit different because their left and right foot took them in opposite directions. And so the currents of life are either going to pull you together as you trust Christ with them, or they're going to pull you apart as you just look at the human aspect of what's going on and your differences in life and say, this can't work. So your growth in your faith and your dependence upon Christ is going to be critical when the currents of life hit you, when you're very different in your marriage relationship.
Mm-hmm. That's a great illustration. And how would you say that you guys have navigated ministry together? Because obviously you've been here for 40 years, and you were doing crusade before that. And what has that looked like for you, as you are so different, and sometimes you work together, and I know sometimes, just tell us a little bit about what that's looked like.
Yeah, and I will say that big aha moment, that the thing that has kept us together is, I can't do two parallel lines and talk, but it's like we've been two parallel lines committed to Jesus Christ since we accepted Him. And it's not that we haven't had our down times. One of my driest times was when he was in seminary, because he was flourishing, learning, but I was on the prairie in East Richardson with three kids, three and under, and I wasn't talking to anybody. So I didn't think I had a ministry. And there were no books out there saying that being a mother was a ministry back then. And Bill would come home from seminary and say, well, what did you do? And I'd say, nothing. Well, you know, cloth diapers, I beg your pardon, 4 dozen cloth diapers 4 times a week. And, you know, putting them down for nap, feeding them, playing with them. But I hadn't talked to anybody about Jesus, so I hadn't done anything. And I got so down and felt so down at that time. But then as we came up here, and we love kids, we did good during that period, but really when we came up to, it was being committed to Christ that has held us together. Girls, that was 4 years ago. And Courtney McClellan had invited us to speak at their community group. And I said, what are we gonna say, Bill? We just had a fight last night. And he goes, well, let me think about it. So he came back and he said, I've got it.
I'm analytical.
And he is. And he said, and for the first time, it wasn't just a quick thing on how we were going to fix it. It was, let me think about it. And when he came back and said, we have been stayed committed to Jesus Christ, sometimes at different levels, he'll be up, I'll be up. But that has been our goal. And Bill is a teacher. He's a leader. He's a design developer. I had to learn to appreciate that and encourage that. I always love the provider part, but because I'm not. But I'm the nurturer, the mentor. I'm the mom. I love being a mom, y'all. I'm just a kid at heart. So it was fun. And that's why I taught teenagers for 20 years, including you and your husband. But anyway, who was Ben's best friends. But, you know, I went from there to teaching teenagers for 20 years to being Moxie, starting that, which is a mentoring program for older women and younger women. And that was just always my heartbeat, was connecting women and mentoring together. And what we did, what we realized is, and so really our ministries have run parallel, where they've not run together. And Bill is over here developing small groups and missions and STEP and all this. And I'm with him. I'm doing STEP. I'm doing different things with him. And I'm going on the mission trips and I'm going to the meetings. But I'm still got my separate ministry too going. And that's just, we work so differently. It's better that way.
And Ann just mentioned something that I just want to comment on, and that is couples tend to be couple-oriented or kid-oriented, okay? And if you tend to be like Ann and I were kid-oriented, I just want you to know the most encouraging thing for your children, the most confidence-building thing for them, the most security-providing thing for them is for them to know that mom and dad love each other. That's more important than if they know that mom and dad love them, because there's a security there of knowing that your home is there and that you care about each other. And that solid foundation and that secure environment is going to continue. And they learn so much about life and so much about who to look for in a mate and everything else from watching your relationship. So I just want you to know, if you tend to be more kid-oriented, focus more on your marriage relationship, because that's the greatest gift you can give to your kids.
And you know what? Your kids will grow up and leave, and they don't want to play with you forever. They've got their own friends. So you're going to have friends again. So don't just get so wrapped up. We did. We did. So anyway, but I will say, just to show you the differences, Bill and I did do a couple of sermons together at the church, one on marriage and one on...
Did I mention sweating?
But here, this is where he has learned. He loves lists. He likes to check them off. They do nothing for me. But so we're going to preach together. I mean, speak this Sunday morning.
On marriage.
On marriage. And he has to write down every word. And I've kind of got the big ideas here. And so I've got to be under pressure. So he finally says, I have got to get some sleep. I said, fine, just go to sleep and leave blanks where I'm supposed to do my talk. So he goes to sleep about 11. I'm up till 2. I fill in those blanks, my two passages that I'm speaking on. I've got 13 minutes. I want you to know I hit it on the nose. Pretty proud of myself. Thank you. But anyway, that...
Pride comes before the fall.
That's true.
I think we're over this morning already.
So. I know. But that was so hard for him to go to bed and not know that I had every word written down. I mean, did you not sweat?
All night.
So, but it's like we have learned, he's learned to say, I know she'll get it done, and I can trust that. And I've also learned to say, thanks to our counselor, when we go on vacation, make Bill a list so that what you want him to get done before you leave, and then Bill, an hour before you go, Ann gets to give all the orders she wants to. You know, turn on the thermostat, put on the remote control for the lights. I mean, that's just where my brain goes. But so that's worked.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about that as we kind of think about how you guys have learned to not only sort of tolerate your differences, but really kind of embrace them and begin to appreciate the differences that each of you bring to your relationship.
Ann and I have a short statement that describes our relationship. She pulls me into life, I keep her out of jail, okay? And so I'm the kind of person
because I would spend all my money and not.
She'd be a bag lady.
I'd be a bag
downstairs,
lady.
That's
what I'd say.
Downtown Little Rock.
I'd be a bag lady on the streets of Little Rock.
Okay, so. So I'm the kind of person who would say I've got to get these things done. I can't pull away. That wouldn't be prudent. You know, that type of thing. She'll go. No, go for it. We need to go for it. So we had a vacation planned to Colorado. And that year there was no snow. We were going with some friends. And I said, well, that's out. I guess we'll stay here. And she said, in talking to our friends, no, they've got a place in South Carolina. We can switch everything. I'm going, no, we're talking about 3 days from now. Yeah, we're going to switch everything. We're going to South Carolina. We're going to stay in Atlanta. I'll take care of all these. When it comes to having an experience, Ann can move at warp speed, okay? So she can get it
done.
Throw
out those ski clothes and put in the bathing suits. That's what I did, just like that.
So we go, we spend the night in Atlanta, and Ann finds out that Halley's Comet is coming by that night. It's the night before Easter. You can actually go up on Stone Mountain in Atlanta and you can see the comet, but you have to go about 3 a.m. We've got 3 teenagers, okay, and then a 4th kid who sleeps all the time anyway. And she says, we're getting up at 3, we're going up on the rail,
tram.
You know, huh? Tram, yeah, tram up there. And we're gonna see the comet and we're gonna experience a great Easter service on top of the mountain. Well, of course, the teenagers felt like I did. We're getting up at what? At 3 a.m. to go see what? And we get up on the top and we don't have any binoculars or anything. Of course, she worms her way into this guy, steals his binoculars.
Hey, I'm a biology major. I had read How to Find the Comet. And he's sitting here going, Mabel, I can't see that thing. And I said, sir, I said, I can help you find the comet if you would let my children and I look through your binoculars. So I did. He found it, and then he handed me the binoculars. And, of course, yeah. I had all 4 kids. And Bill looked at this man, and he goes, you just think you're getting your binoculars back.
Exactly. So the kids look at this, and they say, are you talking about the Q-tip up in the sky? And the aunt says, yeah, that's it. And they went 3 a.m. to see a Q-tip. That's what we're up here for? But the guy who was preaching that morning on Stone Mountain did a phenomenal job. It was one of the best Easter services we've ever been to. Sunrise on top of Stone Mountain.
It was incredible.
And it was a memory. That's what Ann does. She drags you into life. And in fact, next week I'm going fishing in Argentina, and I didn't want to go. But she prayed me to go, okay? So I'm going because she prayed and changed my mind during the day.
No, God changed his mind. He wanted to go.
She doesn't want to take responsibility.
He wanted to go. I'm being humble. He wanted to go. But seriously, I got up the next morning earlier than usual, and he's at the kitchen counter, and he's got 5 reasons why he shouldn't go. All of them, and I said,
I'm a lister.
Uh-huh. And I would usually try to nag him into it, but I thought, you know what? I'm not going to do it. I said, Bill, I said, I know you have to call Pete back by noon, and I said, would you please just pray about this? And I said, I'm just going to pray that God's going to show you whether you're to go or not to go, and that you will listen to him, and really, and whatever you do, I'm at peace with. Now, that is huge. All my friends out there, that is huge for Ann. Is that not a huge star? So anyway, he does. And I get a call at noon, and he goes, well, I've decided to go. I mean, you could have knocked me. I knew he wasn't going, but he is.
I am.
Tell us a little bit. Let's go back to vacation now and what
that
looks like.
I will say, the reason I would be a bag lady is because I never overspend, but I don't save anything. And the one thing that did help our marriage is we had separate checking accounts about 1 year into marriage. We figured we had to do this.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And because I never balanced my checkbook.
I was an accounting major.
Yeah, and
we balance it every month
to the penny. And
Ann says, I still have checks in the checkbook. We must have money.
There you go. So, and you know, I can do math. I did calculus in college, but when I looked on my 7, the reason I didn't want to, it's boring. It's just boring. So, you know.
It might be painful.
It might, but yeah. I've only bounced a few.
Yeah.
That's okay.
So tell us a little bit about vacations now. How do you guys manage those ideal days of Bill kind of being on the beach and doing nothing and Ann wanting to do everything possible?
They can still create tension, okay? And so even when every other day, the person gets to pick their day. So one day I say, this is how we're going to spend vacation today. The next day, Ann says, now this is the plan for today. So we do vacation the way she wants to. But if you're sitting on the beach reading a book and she promised to be back by 4, so there were some other things we could get done, and she doesn't show up until 8, then from 4 to 8, the lister, the person who had other things on the agenda he wanted to get done that day, is madder than a hornet. So when she gets back from her fun day of going out and her experience and the whole thing, etc.,
The guy did cut himself with a machete, and I did have to put Band-Aids on his cut.
And she witnessed to him, so it all worked out perfectly, you know, from her standpoint.
But really, really, the every other day,
that really worked.
We didn't come up to this until 1999, and that really works. And we'd gone to visit our son, who was doing an internship in New York City, and I wanted to go see St. Patrick's Cathedral, and Bill said, no, you'll spend too much time in there. And so after the first day, we came up with this every other day. So he had his day. I always give him first, you know, and that's good because I know I'm going to stretch him. The next day, we're with Daniel walking down Fifth Avenue, and there's St. Patrick's Cathedral. And I went, oh, I said, here's St. Patrick's. I said, let's go in. And he went, well, and he said, oh, it's your day. So we went in. I got to hear a boys' choir that was so darling, weren't they good, for 10 minutes.
Darling.
For 10 minutes. It was beautiful. And then we left after 10 minutes. But the every other day thing, but I tell you, the day on the beach, I was wrong. And but we had read this wonderful book that we totally recommend called Love and Respect. And Bill had it's the only marriage book Bill ever outread me on. We were going to do a chapter every breakfast.
And the videos are even better.
Yeah.
Guy's got a master's in communication, and he is hysterical.
He is. And he totally.
Your husbands would love it.
He totally gets us women, but he totally gets your husband, too. And so the second day, we're supposed to be on chapter 2, and he says, well, chapter 5. I said, we're not on chapter 5. And he goes, well, I just kept on reading. And so, but after I came home too late, we sat in silence for 20 minutes on the beach. You know, it wasn't 8, it was. The sun was still up. But anyway, and all of a sudden...
July.
Who do you trust on what time it was? The 7?
It was not 8.
Or the 3?
It was not... Anyway.
The sun's still up. Are you kidding?
Well, okay, it was 7:49. But anyway, but all of a sudden, and this is in the book. I mean, we would go back to the appendix and read it straight out of the book. But all of a sudden, I hear this voice. And so we're leaving the next day to come home. I think, you know what? We're going to go home mad. We've done that before, the whole plane ride. And all of a sudden, I hear this voice go, I know you are a good-hearted woman, and you did not mean to come home and make me furious. So I'm going to choose to forgive you. And y'all, that turned our whole... I mean, the vacation ended up being a huge win, and it could have been awful. We've had those awful ones. Mm.
Yeah, choosing, making an act of the will,
yes,
is so many times what it is in marriage, right? Instead of right. That feelings basis, which is what the world says it should be. Mm-hmm. One other thing that I thought was just a good little tweak is, Bill used to come home, and you said it earlier, he used to come home and ask you, what did you do today? Very achiever-oriented language, right? And as a mom with all these little people running around, the answer is, you guys know the answer. I have absolutely no idea, but I haven't sat down all day, right? That's the answer.
You haven't even eaten.
Yeah, and so... Tell me a little tweak that you guys made there that made a lot of difference to how you felt when Bill would ask you that question when he came home.
There again, I felt on a performance basis. You know, it's kind of like, what have you done today? Mm-hmm. And that just wasn't in my wheelhouse of what I needed to support me. And at that time, and like you said, you've been putting up with these squats. And I loved the kids. I'd get on the but by 5 o'clock. You know,
the valley of the shadow hour. That's
and so all of a sudden my voice would be up here, you know, when he walks in the door and he goes, I just don't know why you have to use that tone of voice. I mean, when I keep them, they're just fine with me.
I wouldn't respond to
it. I wouldn't respond that way. I mean, you know, he's the one with the anger. But by that time, and that would I would just see red. And but it's like what changed is just over the years. Is he would come in and start saying,
How
did your day go? And so then I could say, oh my gosh, the bug man was here and we were going around and all of a sudden I got into my testimony. I don't know how I did it, but I got to talk to him about the Lord. I mean, I'm serious. And the other day, this guy's coming to remeasure our house for tax purposes. He's a measure.
Appraiser.
And, he knows our son, Bill. Anyway, we sat there and talked about the Lord and what was going on in Fayetteville and his son in college. And he said, well, we do attend church and here periodically. But anyway, I had a great talk with Chris. And when he came in, it's like if he'd said, what did you do? It would have been, you know. But when he said, how did your day go? Then I got to tell him. Because mine is all about relating with people. If I haven't related and encouraged somebody... or talked to them and just made their day better, then I don't feel successful.
Mm, that's a great point.
But you know what's
such
weird?
Such a subtle change.
What's weird? I asked him last night, because we were going over this, I said, so what do you want me to ask you? Do you want me to ask you, how did your day go? Or do you want me to ask you, what did you do? And he goes, I want you to ask me, what did you do? And I thought, that is so boring. But anyway, I'm going to ask him, what did he do? He likes to tell me.
And then she has to listen to me like I have to listen to her.
That's right. That's right.
But what a great question to go home and ask your husband tonight, right? What means more to you? How do you want me to ask you about your day? When you come in and we say the same thing every day, probably, when you get home from work, mm-hmm. What would you like for that question to be? That's an easy conversation starter. Bill, one of the things we talked about, and I can vaguely remember from our premarital counseling, because we're coming up on 20 years, and Bill married us, and he just has some thoughts about what you think the goal of marriage is, and what your conversation is with those young couples as they come in and you ask them, why do you want to get married? Yeah. Tell us about that.
So I love to ask the question, and I do it the very first appointment, and that is, tell me in 25 words or less why you want to marry this person. And of course, it never goes 25 words with the wife or the woman. The man, he does pretty good with that. But 25 words or less why you want to get married. And I hear all of these glowing praises about provider, and she's beautiful, and I think he'll be a nurturer for our kids. I mean, he loves kids, and all of these positive things about each other, and so I say, okay, now this is what the scripture would indicate. So you tell me if you still want to get married with this definition. I want to be the unique tool that God is going to use in my mate's life to help conform them to the image of Christ. Now, do you still want to get married? I'm not so sure now, you know.
Well, and John Trent, remember when he was here, his comment, he said, a better way to ask a girl to marry you is to say, would you please marry me because I really want God to show me how selfish I am. Mm-hmm. He said that would be a better marriage proposal, and that's true for us too.
Yeah.
And so the whole goal there is for you to understand that God uniquely wants to use you. He's gifted every one of us, he tells us in 1 Corinthians, in order to build up the body of Christ. So our gifts are meant to be used, not for ourselves, but our gifts are meant to be used in the body of Christ to build up other people. That's why they've been given to us. In the same way, God has gifted you and made you the way you are in order to help your husband grow. And so if you see that as your goal, it's one of graciously exposing his need for Christ over time and helping him see that, be a reflection back to him of that, and encourage him in that process, then that's a great reason to get married and to be married. And you're if the first definition you give is he's going to do, she's going to do, they're going to do, you're going to be disappointed. Mm. If it is, I get to serve them in order to do this, you're never going to be disappointed in your marriage. Mm.
Mm-hmm. That's a great reminder, both for engaged couples, but also for
married couples.
Yes, yes. As we study the Enneagram, I'm finding that you kind of go through several stages. You come into it, and it's kind of this exciting, new, fascinating tool that feels like somebody's been in your brain. And then you hit the negative side of things, and you kind of go, oh, this isn't quite so fun anymore. But then you circle back again to feeling kind of this acceptance and almost appreciating this new level of awareness, even for your negative tendencies. And you kind of come to a place of accepting those and realizing that they're there and that you could change those now that you're aware of them. But then you hit this point of realizing that change is work. And it's hard, and it takes a lot of energy, and it's not just a fix-it-overnight deal. It's a lifelong process.
I hear you, sister.
And so marriage is a lot in the same way. And so what would you guys say to women who are really at a place where either they're just in a hard season in their marriage, maybe they're both in it together, but they're just having a really hard time, or maybe to people who are in a marriage where their husband is not, like you guys said, the key for your marriage has been that you've both been pursuing Jesus. And so what would you say maybe to some women in the room who aren't in that situation where they and their husband are both pursuing Jesus? How would you just encourage us in those hard situations?
I was just helping lead a table this morning at Robert Lewis's Man to Man over at the Embassy Suites. And I've got six young guys around this table who are anywhere from 25 to 45. That's how I define young. 25 to 45. And I'm asking them, where are you guys in your time alone with God? And they're nowhere. Now, they would all tell you they're Christians, but they're nowhere. Where are you when it comes to really a commitment to Him, being in a relationship with other men who can hold you accountable and encourage you? And they're nowhere. None of them have a group that they're a part of. And so you're sitting here, and I'm going, okay, this is reality. I mean, this is the way life is for many, many people, and this is where many, many men are. But they're coming to 10 weeks of this to try to get more motivated, to get more insight, maybe to take a step in the right direction. I don't know where your husbands are, but I want you to know that's where most guys are. They're trying to figure out how to get from point A to point B, and they're trying to take some baby steps in knowing how to do that, and yet they're not really committed to a process yet to get there, to accomplish that. So here's my encouragement to you ladies, okay? And that is, you've got to play the long game. Now, that doesn't sound good when we live in a culture of instant gratification, in which everything needs to happen in a one-half-hour sitcom. It all gets resolved in a short period of time. That's not life. In fact, God uses the word sanctification in the Scripture, where He says, you became a Christian, justification, when I brought you into a relationship with Myself. Now the rest of life is sanctification. It is a setting apart of yourself toward Me, so that in the end, glorification takes place, and that's the part that God finishes. But the word salvation in the Scripture describes all three of those things. It describes the beginning, the process, and the conclusion. And so your husband's coming to know Christ is a process, from coming to know Him to really walking with Him to finally being conformed to Him. And I just want you to know, you have to play the long game. And in this conference, we're talking about love and respect. It tells men, it commands a man in Ephesians 5 to love his wife as Christ loved the church. And why does it command him to do that? Because it's not natural to him to unconditionally love his wife. So here I am, an achiever, and I'm supposed to unconditionally love this person who runs from preparation and organization and all those kind of things. You know, in my Enneagram, it says, to get along with me, be organized and prepared. Whoa. Oh, also, goals put me at ease. Okay, so we're not at ease at our house a lot, okay?
And I will say, we were when I was raising children, because they were pressure. And remember, if Ann's under pressure, I get things done. So, but as soon as we became empty nesters, oh, it was a challenge.
Yes, yes. So I need to love her, and that's the long game for me as a husband, is to do that. And when I don't love her, as he says in this book, I stand on her air hose. She cannot breathe if she's not being loved, unconditionally loved. Here's what I want you to understand from the man's side of the equation. What a man needs more than anything is unconditional respect. Now, I know you think that's an oxymoron statement right there, because respect in our culture has to be earned, right? It's got to be earned. Well, does your love have to be earned? That's not biblical, is it? In the same way, in the Ephesians 5 passage where it says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, it says, and wives, respect your husbands. And the reason is because respect is what communicates love to a man. Aretha Franklin may have sung the song, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. The song was written by Otis Redding.
That's right.
It's written by a man, because that's what a man needs more than anything, is unconditional respect. It doesn't mean that you applaud or you support or you in any way encourage him moving in the wrong directions in life, but it means that you find ways to encourage and to respect him in the things that he does well. And I'm more built up and more encouraged and more drawn toward Anne when she says, I admire, I respect, I appreciate, than I am for, because when she says, I love you, I go, yeah, and you love the puppy dog next door and you love me, and you know, because women naturally love, okay? But do you respect me? I know you love me, but do you like me? And that's the question every man is asking of his wife.
And,
do you like me?
And what Emerson Eggerich says in his book, he said they did a study of 400 men and said, for the rest of your life, would you
rather be left alone in a world unloved or feel inadequate and disrespected?
Yep. And in other words, would you rather go your whole life and never hear I love you, or would you rather go your whole life, or would you not want to go your whole life and hear I'm not respected? And every one of the 400 said they would rather have respect than love.
Now, that's the way a harmonizer shares that story.
That's right.
Okay?
Yeah.
It's 74% of the men. Okay.
Oh, well, okay. Sorry. I got that. But, and I will say, you know, this is, you can't be a cop-out on whatever your number is. I mean, yeah, I don't like tasks. But if I really love him and what he needs is an order, he needs some order in the house for him to truly relax, then you know what? I have to, and I think I should do this myself, but I can't. And God just told me the other day, he said, why do you think you can do it? You're weak. So I just have to throw down and say, God, I can't even go through that pile of papers and magazines because I just don't want to make a decision on what to do with them. And so, I'm going to get up off the couch, and I'm going to go over there, and you're going to have to do it. So, because that's showing love for my husband. That's not just running from it and avoiding it, because that's the easiest thing for me. So, you have to look at what he needs, and that's where you have to change. You have to ask God to change you and to work on that, because that's not easy for me. And, you know, I really have learned to say to Bill, make respectful statements. And for me, for number five,
and she does a great job. Oh, you know.
I've gotten better, but for number five, I tell him all the time. I said, "Thank you so much for paying our bills." I said, "I so admire you for doing that, and for our taxes. I mean, you know, fix him a special meal." He keeps saying he's going to die first. I said, "You can't. I'll be in jail for tax evasion. I've never done my taxes, and I don't want to do my taxes." So, but just to say, I admire you for that. If you're married to a two, just say, "You're the best at getting our family to try new things, and I admire that about you." When Bill speaks, I always tell him, I say, "You know what, honey? Here's what, you did a great job, and here's what I learned." You have to be specific, but you have to, and we need that too. So when he comes to me and he said, "You know, you are so great." I mean, the other day he just showed a picture of me talking to a homeless man in Philadelphia about the Lord, and he's so proud of that. He took a picture and he showed it to everybody. And for him to say that, that is so validating to me. And it's fun that you finally get each other.
And for me, like in the Love and Respect book, he has an acronym for men. It's called COUPLE. And I've learned that for Anne, it really fits her personality well. That closeness, the C, okay? Closeness, openness, understanding, peacemaking, saying, "I'm sorry, will you forgive me?" Okay? Loyalty, and esteeming her. Those things and the words that go with them cause her to feel validated and to feel loved and cared about. And so in that book, the great thing is at the end of each of those chapters, it gives you about 10 or 15 things that a man can say to his wife. And then CHAIR is the acronym for women. And it gives you 10 or 15 things at the end of each chapter you can say to your husband to make him feel respected.
That's good.
Wow. Yeah. Those are so good. All right. We've got to kind of wrap it up today. I wish we could sit here and talk to you guys for another hour. This has been awesome. But
Anne would love that.
I know. You would be worried about all the things that you have on your list to get done. But your final word, after almost 50 years, what is your best advice to couples?
I think one I would give you is that your mate's weaknesses are a gift from God. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't see them that way at all. But when do you pray the most? When do you seek God's guidance the most? And it's when you're in need. And God allows you to be married to someone with weaknesses in order to focus you more on Him and to trust Him more. And let me tell you, you cannot change your husband's heart. You can't do it. I don't care how much you cajole and plead and berate and whatever word you want to use, whatever mood you're in, okay? You cannot change him. But it will cause you to spend time on your knees praying for him. And it will cause you to want to grow more in your spiritual life in order to make him hungry for what he sees in you. His weaknesses, not his strengths, are God's greatest gift to you if you see them in that light and you pursue God to see changes in those ways.
And I would just say, if your husband's not interested in taking the test, don't push it. Don't talk about it. Because, you know, it's like Bill said, you're in it for the long haul. And there's got time. God can work on him. But what you realize is, in our circle of your marriage, there's usually one person that's more spiritually wanting to see things happen. And that's the person that God's going to start with. And oftentimes it is the woman, because we're more in tune with our emotions. And so that is where you can't change him. You can only change yourself. And that's where you start praying. You start giving it to the Lord. And the other thing is to just realize and don't tell him what he is. I mean, I made Bill so mad back in another test. I would always say, oh, yeah, that's your side. And it would make him furious. So just God.
Guys don't like to be pigeonholed.
No, they don't. They don't. But here's the deal. What God finally slapped me up the side of the head, because we women are fixers. And he just said, so, Ann, you try to work it out first, and then you come to me and pray. So what you're saying is you think you can do a better job than I can. And I went, oh, God, that is so arrogant for me to think that I can do it better than you, and I need to go. And when I've gone to God first and give it to him, then miracles happen. And I can guarantee you it gets easier and better, and life is much stress-free. Mm-hmm.
And that will be true with your children.
That's right.
As well.
That's right.
Don't smother your kids. You're going to have to give them the same room to grow you give your husband.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trusting God with your husband and with your kids, and I know that was one of the things that we talked about the other day.
Our kids did not all have smooth paths to pastor, okay?
Yes. Maybe next year you can come back and we can talk parenting. Yeah.
But what I want to say is both of our siblings, Bill has two, I have two, they're both divorced. And I guarantee you, apart from Jesus Christ, we would be too.
Long time ago.
Because I was always right. Seriously. I was always right, and he had a temper. And so we would not have made it. But here we are, 50 years down the road. Our kids are from 47 to 40. They're all, and I'm not saying we've had other friends that have been just as faithful as us, and maybe they've got a loose cannon. But, I mean, ours, no family's perfect. But they're walking with the Lord. We're intact. And, y'all, that didn't come easy. A family portrait. Bill used to say this. A family portrait is not created in a day. It looks real good on Facebook or real good on your wall. But that doesn't just happen. You got to stick it in there. And you can do it. I know you can.
Yeah. Let's give them a hand. Well, I hope that you have been challenged today, but I hope that you've also been encouraged that marriage is hard. But when you both are seeking after Jesus, then that gives you that common goal, and that's really the only way that we can make it. And so I appreciate you guys being here today, taking the time to come. Yeah. And let me pray for us as we close, and then we'll get you guys to your small groups. God, I just thank you for these two right here, Bill and Ann, and just the way you've created them, God, the way that you put them together, the way that they refine each other, and the way that they glorify you, God. It's such an example. It's such an encouragement. And, God, it's an encouragement to me that even now they still are continuing to work on their relationship, that they continue to discover things that they need to change and things that they can do to love the other person well. Even after almost 50 years of marriage, God, I pray that you would give us the wisdom that we have learned from them today. I pray that you would give us the courage and the willingness to put it into practice, God, to do the hard work that is required to love our husbands well, God, and to love you well. And I just pray that you would go with us today. Would you give us a renewed sense of courage in our marriage, a new sense of your love for us and a love for our husbands, God. We love you and praise you. In Jesus' name, amen.